Well, here in the Midwest, right at the moment, we're experiencing some fairly chilly temperatures for this time of year. And as you have just heard in the newscast, of course, there are other parts of the country that are really struggling to get out from under winter, where it's been very cold and very snowy. It hasn't been all that bad here, but I'm sure that here, as well as there, a lot of places around the United States, people are getting kind of tired of winter, and they're starting to look forward to spring and to summer. And so here's a bit of information that perhaps will give you some hope. There are only 26 days, 6 hours, 57 minutes, and currently 46 seconds until opening day. My source there is the website of Major League Baseball, and the clock is continuing to count down. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we will talk a little bit about a ballpark that many people consider to be the most perfect place for baseball in the United States. And the place we're talking about is Wrigley Field. It was built in 1914. It will be playing host to Major League Baseball for the 92nd season this year and to the Cubs for the 90th year. That's remarkable longevity for a ballpark. If you go back to the very beginning, some of the important features won't be there at the beginning. There was no ivy on the walls. In fact, there was no scoreboard. There were no bleachers. There were no lights. There were no Cubs. However, it is remarkable how little the ballpark changed once its basic features got put into place. And in fact, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Stuart Shea, says perhaps if we could go back in time and we could take a Cubs fan from those early years and bring him into the future and show him the park, he wouldn't really notice very much in the way of important differences. The skyline, of course, would be different, but the park itself, in a lot of respects, wouldn't be that different. We are talking this morning with Stuart Shea about his book, Wrigley Field, The Unauthorized Biography. Brassies is the publisher. Stuart Shea is a former baseball columnist for Total Sports and also America Online. He served as associate editor for Barnes & Noble's Baseball Encyclopedia, and he co-authored two editions of the USA Today Baseball Weekly Insider, and he makes his home in Chicago. He's talking with us by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. Certainly, if you're listening in Chicago or any place around the Midwest here, 800-222-9455. In fact, if you might happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that toll-free line. So again, locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Shea, hello.
How are you, David?
Good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Very
it's
good.
It's chilly up here.
Yeah, well, it is kind of down here, but as I said, when you heard about what was happening in the Northwest, or the Northeast, I guess we should say, well, okay, maybe it's not too bad here in
so
our
far.
Part of the country.
So far, so good. I think it's going to get worse. But,
could be.
You can listen to spring training games on the radio, that everything seems much warmer to me.
Absolutely. Is Wrigley Field the park that has been has the distinction of being the park that's been in the longest continuous use?
My understanding is that it's the second oldest major league ballpark after Fenway.
Ah, okay.
It's amazing when you think about the fact that really there are only three old ballparks left in the major leagues. There's Wrigley, there's Fenway, and there's Yankee Stadium. The fourth oldest ballpark is Dodger Stadium, and that park is only a little more than 40 years old. It's rather amazing to me that Dodger Stadium is something we sort of associate with the 60s and with the Dodgers moving from Brooklyn to the West Coast, and already that has the fourth longest seniority of any major league park.
Yeah. It is kind of remarkable, I think, when you you think about the demands now and recently on big sports stadiums, what it is that people think you got to have, that Wrigley should have in so many ways be so like it was in 1914. I mean, yes, it's true. There are lights now, and I'm sure that there are a lot of amenities that the park has now that it didn't. But as I think you say in the book, in a lot of ways, it hasn't changed. And it seems really remarkable that it, for such a long time, essentially it has remained the same place.
I think you raised a really good point, David. And I think that what this tells me, what the success of places like Fenway and Wrigley and Yankee Stadium and and the love people had for places like Tiger Stadium in Detroit, even County Stadium in Milwaukee, which actually is my second favorite ballpark, I think those things indicate that really what people want out of baseball is very different than what people might want out of football or hockey or basketball as far as what they're going to see. I think that the reason that baseball continues to be popular is that it's nothing like American life. In other words, it has nothing to do with the way that we live now, which is fast-paced, quick-cutting, reliant on the whims of the moment. Baseball is different than that. It rewards careful and patient attention. There's a magazine up here that serves the Wrigley Field community called The Heckler, which has shirts that they sell that say, baseball isn't boring, you are. And I think that that's the attitude a lot of people who are manic baseball fans have. Mm. In other words, people who say baseball is boring are just missing the point. And that any attempt to make baseball more like the other sports tends to sort of miss the point of baseball, which is that it's open-ended and very, very much standing for things that have lasted a long time. The game is very similar to the way it was back then in Wrigley Field, as a park that is in many ways similar to the way it was 90 years ago. It's a perfect representative of that. People love things that remind them of the good things about baseball times before you had to worry about things like designer drugs. And Wrigley Field really is a place that has a hold on people the way few other sports arenas in baseball do, because you really feel like you're walking into a piece of the past.
Yeah.
It still has that feel on people. It still has that effect.
Back at the beginning, it was not called Wrigley Field, and the Cubs didn't play there. Well,
right.
Let's talk about the guy who actually built Wrigley Field.
This is a story in itself. In fact, I'm putting together now a proposal to write a book about a man named Charles Wiegman. Charles Wiegman was a guy from Indiana who had big dreams of making it in the city in Chicago in the late 1800s. Came to Chicago, got off a train with $5 in his pocket. Within 10, 12 years, he was a millionaire. He got a job at a restaurant called Charlie King's in the South Loop in Chicago and soon became head waiter, became a very, very popular figure with all the people who went to the restaurants in those days, which were the show people, the newspaper people, the athletes, the gamblers, the cops, the politicians. And he opened up his own string of quick lunch restaurants downtown, serving fast food to office workers, basically. He made $1 million in 10 years, and he wanted into baseball. So he bought a stake in an independent league team called the Chicago Whales, who were in the Federal League, and he built a new ballpark for them. Baseball had never been played on a professional basis on the north side of Chicago before 1914, but the Whales built a park in Wrigleyville, which then was called Lakeview, and it was only recently built neighborhood. It was a place where people who had money were going to buy sort of weekend residences because it was 30 blocks north of downtown, which was still sort of a distance. And it was sort of unconquered virgin land to a certain extent at that time, and it was cheap land, and it was where the sort of happening go-go places were opening. So this was very much an adventurous place to build a ballpark on the north side of the city. The Cubs at that point were playing in the west side of the city, west of downtown, at a dilapidated old park called West Side Grounds. After the Federal League played for 2 years and the Chicago team played in this new ballpark, Wiegman was allowed to buy the Cubs as part of the agreement to disband the Federal League. The reason the Major Leagues wanted to get rid of the Federal League is because having an extra baseball league in there was driving up salaries because there was more competition for the good players. So Wiegman, as the most powerful and richest owner of the Federal League, was allowed to buy the Cubs, and he moved the Cubs into this ballpark for 1916, and the rest is history.
Yeah. As you mentioned, he was first involved in this league called the Federal League, and his team, I guess at one point, was just called the Chicago Federals.
Right, the Chi-Feds.
The Chi-Feds, and apparently people called it a lot of other things, too, but before it was called the Whales. And I guess that just kind of tickles me that why a team located in the center of the United States, a long way from saltwater, why would you name your baseball team the Whales?
Well, it was actually the decision to name the team the Whales was actually a very forward-thinking piece of promotion by Wiegman. He actually sponsored a contest to name the team, and the winner of the contest got season tickets. So after the 1914 season, know that he would like very much to have people send in their suggestions for naming the team. And since Wegman was a very, very well-known restaurant owner, a lot of the names that people sent in were things like the buns and the donuts and things like that, just things that seem so quaint and ridiculous to us now for the name of a baseball team. But even the Whales had apparently sort of a backhanded food reference, because Wegman was famous for his sandwiches, which were very large. And I don't know if you remember that Burger King used to have a fish sandwich called the Whaler.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Back in the day. And, sure. And I think that in some ways it was sort of the same idea, that this was sort of a big sandwich. So his sandwiches were thought of as whales. But there was also the context that the sort of winning fan came up with, saying, well, whales drub their opponents, they're big and strong, and they're the biggest creatures in the sea, and we, you know, Chicago is the greatest city in the nation, and we want to have the best team. So there was sort of that part of it that appealed to, I think, Wegman's sense of adventure and strength.
Yeah. The other story I like is that apparently the site of Wrigley Field was at one point occupied by a seminary,
yeah.
a religious seminary. I think this was, in fact, a Lutheran seminary.
Yes, it was a theological seminary. The community there that wanted to study in contemplation bought this land and didn't really figure on it becoming a big, crazy industrial area with bars and restaurants and train tracks and dairy distributorships and cattle and railway crossings. So after a fairly short time, it became very clear that nobody was going to be able to get any studying done here. And so the seminary moved to the southwest side of the city, and I believe is now in the suburbs. But there's still a strong Lutheran presence in the neighborhood, still a lot of churches. And the guy who owned that land also actually founded the first private hospital in Chicago, which is now one of the biggest hospitals in the country. So there's it's a very fascinating story. You could probably write a whole book on the history of that piece of land itself, because organized baseball did an awful lot to try to keep Charles Wegman from building a ballpark on that piece of land. The major leagues, the American and National League, did not want the Federal League to exist because it would drive up their salaries. They'd have to pay their players more to keep from jumping to a rival league. So there were all sorts of machinations to keep Wegman from being able to buy the land and build the park.
Classic
Chicago politics.
Yeah, for sure. The man must have wanted in baseball awful bad, because he'd spent an awful lot of money. He spent a lot of money building the park, and then when he bought controlling interest in the Cubs, he, according to your book, paid $500,000, which is the most anybody had ever paid for a major league team. And I'm sure that in 1915, $500,000, $500,000 was real money in those days.
Yeah, you can hardly live on that now. yes, it was a huge transaction. And a lot of people believed at the time, I think, that Wegman had been suckered. And I think in a way he was. But Wegman was the kind of guy who had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He was a self-made man, to the extent that he came here with $5 and he, 10 years later, had $1 million. And he wanted into baseball very badly. He had tried to buy teams before, and the fact that he had been rebuffed was one of the reasons that he really enjoyed sticking it to organized baseball by making the Federal League as successful as it was, and basically forcing his way into the game. Now, unfortunately, Wegman turned out not to be the world's greatest businessman, and when things were going bad, it really went to hell in a bucket for him. Between the war and the influenza epidemic and his own overspending, both on the baseball team and on his own lavish personal lifestyle, he ended up losing his money fairly quickly and had to sell the team to William Wrigley of the Wrigley Gum Company by 1918.
Yeah. We have a caller here, someone who's calling from Chicago. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Stuart Shea. He's a baseball writer, sports writer, former baseball columnist for Total Sports and America Online. He's the author of the book, Wrigley Field, The Unauthorized Biography. It's published by Brassey. So if you're interested in baseball, if you're a Cubs fan, you might want to take a look at the book. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere. You can hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with this caller in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, great. Enjoying the discussion. Actually, had kind of a tortured existence. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I was a Cubs fan, so it probably explains a lot of my life there. But actually, I had two comments and a question, and I'll hang up because I'm on the cell phone.
Okay.
Old Westside Park, if I understand it correctly, being an alumni from UIC, is actually now on Wood Street, is actually on the medical grounds of the medical college there for UIC. And I was wondering also, too, with the changes at Wrigley Field, the one thing that I despair the most, I guess, I know it's a necessary evil, are the baskets. Because I remember, I'm 50 years old, I can remember back in the 60s, Adolfo Phillips, which was a center fielder, making these headlong plunges into the wall. And with the baskets to keep the litter off the field, a lot of those plays off the wall, of course, are no more. And then one other question I had, it's a long-standing argument I have with a friend of mine. He contends that the Cubs were playing on the day of the Little Bighorn when Custard was massacred out west. And I said, no, there was no baseball back then. And he contends, no, there was a headline. So I don't know if your author can speak to any or all of those topics, but again, I'm enjoying the discussion. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thanks for the calls. Well, I don't know, you can take those in whatever order you want.
Well, I think that, I mean, those are really good points. First of all, I feel for the guy. Obviously, he's lived a very tortured existence being a Cubs fan, grew up on the South Side. There's that great Gene Shepard routine, actually, about being a White Sox fan on the North Side. Do you know what it's like to be a South Sider in a world of North Siders?
Mm.
And, you know, in Chicago, it's as intense as saying what church do you go to, or what neighborhood do you live in, what team do you pull for. And I think probably down where you are, actually, there's a lot of rivalry between Cubs fans and Cardinals fans.
Oh, absolutely.
So, as far as the baskets were put up in 1970 after there was a ruckus on opening day. A lot of fans jumped out of the bleachers and out of the field. Opening day 1970 at Wrigley Field was really sort of when the 60s came to Wrigley. There were a bunch of people in town for a political protest, and a lot of fans were just crazy and drunk and God knows what else. And there was basically a riot on the field after the game. Fans jumped on the field from the bleachers and ran on and started knocking down players and Andy Frayne ushers and things like that. So shortly after that, the Cubs put in this basket to try to keep people from jumping over the wall, and it has worked.
Hmm.
As much, you know, I mean, I don't know if physically the basket itself would keep anybody who really had an idea of jumping from jumping, but it seems to be sort of a psychological deterrent. Like, remember where you are here. You're at a ballpark, you know. Here to watch the game. But it has taken away, as your caller noted, the ability to just sort of reach over and make these amazing catches, plucking the ball off the top of the wall. Opening day 1965, Curt Flood, the great center fielder of the Cardinals, made a catch that Harry Carey, who was broadcasting the game, said that he had never seen anything like that catch. And it was a classic catch. It landed him on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And it's the kind of catch you can't make now because the basket is in the way, which is a bit of a shame.
Hmm.
Let's see. As far as the Little Bighorn, I'm just trying to look up the date of that right now to see if they're actually...
That was June
1876,
yeah.
Yeah, well, the Cubs... Well, the Chicago White Stockings, which was one of the charter franchises in the National League, was playing in 1876. And I would assume that at that point, I can go to the Retro Sheet website here. By the way, if you're a baseball history fan... One of the greatest websites in the world is RetroSheet.org. It has scores, box scores, statistics for games going back to 1871. It's completely free. It's a really unbelievable website, and it helped me a lot in my work. Now, June 25, 1876 was a Sunday, and the Cubs were not playing that day, or the White Stockings were not, but they did play the day before and the day after. So technically, I think the caller's friend is right in that the franchise was playing at the time with the Little Bighorn, which is really kind of incredible.
I guess I wouldn't have. I would have had the same thought that said, "Well, no, it didn't. It didn't go back that far." But the answer is no. Yeah, it did.
And really, the history of professional baseball in this country began truly in 1871 with the National Association. Most people believe now that the first true professional league was the National League, which began in 1876. But the Cubs were a charter member of that league. And they did play on what is now the University of Illinois Chicago Medical Campus on a street called Taylor Street, which in Chicago is famous for being a neighborhood full of fantastic Italian restaurants. after the Cubs left the West Side grounds, really that was sort of the beginning of the end of the West Side, which was hit hard by the war. It was hit hard by the Eastland disaster. And when the Cubs left the neighborhood, it really sort of sounded the death knell for that part of the city. At one time it was called the Glorious West Side, and it truly was the one of the most moneyed areas of the city. From that point, it went into a cycle of despair for about 40 or 50 years.
Okay,
well, it shows the effect that a Major League Baseball park can have on a neighborhood and on a city. After the Cubs began playing at Wrigley Field, the neighborhood really went into a very, very sharp upturn that lasted until the, I'd say, the mid to late 50s.
And that's, I guess, another one of the things about the park that's really interesting is the integration of the park and the neighborhood. And the fact that people think about, they call it Wrigleyville. I mean, it has really shaped the neighborhood and the idea. And I'm sure again that there's not a lot of places where you now have a major league ballpark and it is surrounded like that with a residential area.
That's one of the charms of Wrigley Field, I believe, and one of the very important factors in the success of the ballpark. I tend to put the history of Wrigley Field and the history of its neighborhood into three very separate sections. I would say that from about 1914 to, I'd say, 1945 was the era of growth of the ballpark, the team, and the neighborhood. The Cubs were a great franchise in the 1920s and 30s. They won National League pennants in 29, 32, 35, 38, and through some very aggressive marketing on the part of the Wrigleys and very fan-friendly policies started with Charles Wiegman and continued through the Wrigleys, that even when the Cubs weren't winning, it was a beautiful ballpark that attracted families. And at that time, that was not something that was the rule of thumb in baseball. Mm. Baseball was still seen in the 10s and 20s as kind of a coarse game, not suitable for families or women. And the Cubs really helped change that to a very liberal policy of ladies' days, which created a strong female fan contingent that really continues to this day amongst the Cubs. After the war, really the second phase of Wrigley Field and the Cubs begins, which is a cycle of failure that went on for almost 40 years. People started moving out of the neighborhood after the war to the suburbs, and the neighborhood went down economically at the same time that the Cubs were really reaping the consequences of not having spent money on a farm system, not signing black and Latin players. So in the 50s and 60s, the Cubs were a very poor team, and they were drawing very badly, and the neighborhood really was sort of going down slowly. The Cubs had a flurry in the late 60s in which they became competitive for about 7 years, and they didn't win. Had they won, I think that the neighborhood would have taken an uptick even earlier. But it was only in the early 80s when the Tribune Company bought the team, started pumping more money into Wrigley Field, that people moved back to Wrigley. At that time, some real estate developers began buying cheap land, renaming the area Wrigleyville, and sort of staging this place as a place where young people could buy cheap property and live in a hip neighborhood. And the Cubs became good almost immediately, and since then attendance has gone up almost every year. So I really think it's the integration of the ballpark, the neighborhood, the city itself, and the people who live in that neighborhood. It's critical to understanding the history of Wrigley Field.
Let's talk with somebody else. We have a listener here in Indiana on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I remember a few years ago there was bricks falling off that building, hitting people or something. What have they done about the structural integrity of a building or, you know, structure that's that old, you know, just from soot and stuff, the mortar and everything? I'm just wondering what's going on there.
Very important question, very good question. One of the reasons that Comiskey Park, which was built around the same time as Wrigley, a few years earlier, but one of the reasons that Comiskey Park had to come down in the early 90s is because literally the park had not been taken care of in the early years. What I'm told is that architecturally, to preserve a building for the long term, you have to really take care of it in the early years in which it's built. The first 10 to 20 years are absolutely critical. And the problem is that after the White Sox threw the 1919 World Series and the Sox went into the dumper, basically, as far as the standings and as far as attendance, the Comiskeys stopped spending money on maintaining the ballpark in the 20s. so that by the 60s, the park was sort of dilapidated and old. And in, I believe it was opening day 1987 or 88, a big chunk of concrete fell out of the upper deck in right field and almost brained somebody. And that at that point, it became clear that the park really couldn't stand for much longer. Wrigley Field, on the other hand, was taken care of much, much better in its first 10 to 20 years because every year the Wrigleys would repaint the ballpark. They had a huge crew of people keeping it clean. In fact, keeping the ballpark clean, pristine, every year was part of their marketing plan. Most other ball teams didn't see the park as an asset, but the Wrigleys did. They knew that you couldn't necessarily guarantee a winning team, but you could guarantee a clean ballpark and a good experience for people. So keeping the ballpark in good shape was a huge part of their plan. Now, that being said, the park's 90 years old, and there are structural issues. And in any park that old, there are going to be structural issues. They have the upper deck was put in 1926 and 1927, and over the years they have reinforced the concrete several times. They had a huge campaign in the 50s and 60s to do that, and in the late 80s when they built the luxury boxes and transferred the press box to the upper deck, they had to do some reinforcement as well. But last year there were some instances of chunks of concrete falling. Nobody got hit by them, but they were large enough that this was a problem. In fact, I work at Wrigley Field about 45 to 50 games a season as a reporter for Major League Baseball's website, and I found a chunk about the size of a razor blade last year that had fallen into my path as I was walking up the ramp to the upper deck, and I reported it, and I certainly have an interest in not wanting to go down in a crumbling ballpark. So it was definitely a concern to me as someone who spends a lot of time there, as it would be for anybody who's a fan. My understanding is that they've been spending the offseason reinforcing the concrete, trying to get rid of some of the ugly joins between old concrete and rusted out piping. In fact, they've done a lot of that work in the last year or so. My understanding is that it's being done to everyone's satisfaction, that the reason the Cubs are now able to move along with their current expansion plans is because they have done a good job responding to the concerns about the concrete. I think that at some point there's a possibility that the Cubs may have to vacate Wrigley Field for a year so that some of it can be rebuilt. And if they did that, they would probably have to play at Comiskey, which for a lot of Cub fans would probably be a disconnect to the level of playing in St. Louis or something.
Our guest, Stuart Shea, he's former baseball columnist for Total Sports and America Online. He served as associate editor for Barnes & Noble's Baseball Encyclopedia. He co-authored two editions of the USA Today Baseball Weekly Insider. He makes his home in Chicago and is the author of the book Wrigley Field, The Unauthorized Biography, published by Brassey's Incorporated. So if you like baseball, if you're a Cubs fan, it's a book I'm sure that you would enjoy. Questions are welcome here too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking a little bit ago about the relationship between the neighborhood and the people who live there and the park and the team. And I'm thinking about one of the bits of information that I think is pretty interesting, given all the kind of hoo-ha over the last few years about people watching the game from rooftops, surrounding rooftops, that in fact, until the end of the Second World War, you couldn't do that. And people were actually arrested from their own roofs.
That's right.
Were arrested.
Pulled up their own rooftops. It was seen as being unsafe to be on a rooftop, even if it was your own rooftop. There were concerns about, you might just fall off and break your neck. So I think there were also questions about the structural safety of the building. And what seems to have happened after World War II, after people had been risking their lives in the Pacific and in Europe for a few years, it seems like a lot of the rules and regulations that had sort of guided the 30s, between prohibition and rules about social conduct and something as minor as sitting on your own roof, it seems just like that rule kind of just dissipated and people didn't really pay much attention to it anymore. Because by the 50s and 60s, one of the benefits of living in that neighborhood is you could just take a lawn chair up and sit on your roof and watch a ball game. But before then, it was just not done. People were arrested. And even as late as 1984, there's a great book called called Dodger Dogs and Fenway Franks. It was the first book really to be sort of a chronicle of taking a ballpark tour all around the country. there are a lot of books like that now, but this was the first. Even in 1984, when that book was done, there was a very strong reaction from Wrigley Field fans about people selling the space on top of the roofs. And it was only later on in the 90s that people began to sort of challenge that idea again and say, well, you know, there's money to be made here. Let's open up a club. And the Cubs, as they always do, have found a great way to turn the situation to their advantage, which is now that they've made the rooftop owners partners. They basically threatened to sue them and use that leverage to become partners of the rooftop owners. And they take a cut of the business as sort of a licensing right, and they are now part of the coalition of rooftop owners. It's a rather amazing story as to how it's classic Chicago politics as embodied by Mayor Daley, which is keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with someone here listening down in our area in Danville, nearby community, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I miss, unfortunately, the first 10 minutes of this, and I've just been fascinated with the description of the history and physical aspects of Wrigley Field. But I've been a longtime Cubs fan, and I have wished that someone would talk about the logistics of operating the current team, how many uniforms each player gets, who takes care of them, who makes the accommodations for travel to other places, and just a host of things. And I do hear I mostly listen to the games on the radio, but they do say that the starting pitcher gets to choose the uniform of the day. Is that true in other ball teams? And if this is beyond the purview of what you've selected for today's topic, but if it is, I sure hope we develop a whole hour on those aspects of a baseball team, and particularly the Cubs.
Well, I expect it's something that our guest knows about.
I bet.
Can you talk about that, Stuart?
I can certainly speak to some of those issues. I think those are actually great questions because you sort of wonder, well, who takes care of all that stuff? As far as the team travel, every team has a traveling secretary who is responsible for getting flights chartered, airplane flights chartered, and getting all the hotels booked and passing out the daily meal money and things like that. They actually get envelopes with their sort of daily per diem meal money, and they get keys for their hotel. All this is under the purview of the traveling secretary. And that is a job that has been, there has been a traveling secretary in baseball for, I'd say, at least 80 to 90 years, because there has always been a need to have travel. Back in the older days, it was train travel, of course, but they always had hotels. And back in the old days, players used to actually have to room together to save money, and now I believe players get their own rooms. Or else if they're rooming together, they're rooming in suites rather than. Back in the old days, they actually had to sleep in the same bed. There's a very silly story about the old Philadelphia Athletics in the 10s or 20s, in which I believe there was a catcher named Ozzie Schreckenghost who had a habit of eating crackers in bed, and his roommate wanted a clause put in his contract that he would not have to room with Ozzie Schreckenghost if he continued to eat crackers in bed. So right now, this is not something that players have to worry about. There's probably not going to be somebody in their bed eating crackers. As far as the uniforms, the Cubs do allow the starting pitcher for the day to choose which uniform top they want to wear, which is why that whenever Carlos Zambrano is pitching, you will see the Cubs wearing their dark blue uniform tops, whether they're at home or on the road. I believe that Kerry Wood likes the white jersey. I think Mark Pryor likes the blue jersey. Last year, I think Matt Clement liked the blue jersey, and I think Greg Maddux prefers the white jersey. Yes, that is sort of a rarity, I think, in baseball, because a lot of teams don't have alternate home jerseys except on things like special days or Sundays. And as far as the number of jerseys players get, I think they get several different uniform tops. Every team has a clubhouse manager who is responsible for taking care of those things. And there is, in every ballpark, not only a home clubhouse manager, but also a visiting clubhouse manager who takes care of every visiting team that comes in town. And I think that is a very difficult job because you have to take care of equipment and lockers for as many different teams as come to town in a year. In the National League, there are 15 teams that come to Wrigley Field, plus whatever interleague games they have. So being a visiting clubhouse manager, especially in a visiting clubhouse that is as cramped and old as the one in Wrigley Field, is a very difficult job. And those guys are paid very, very well for their work.
That's an interesting question. So do you? I don't suppose you would know offhand something like if you looked at the budget for the team, how much was spent to maintain the team, and if you took out salaries, and then if you also took out the amount of money that they spent to maintain the park, to try to keep it in shape and cut the grass and all that kind of stuff, how much money would be left on other things like that, on uniforms, for example, on travel, and all those sort of incidental things that's not salary and that's not park infrastructure?
That's good. Those are good questions. I think a lot of the equipment is bought on bulk bases, and the teams get a deal. And, of course, things like shoes and mats are often provided to the players for free or for very low cost as promotional tools.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin is able to say, well, we're the official shoe supplier to the Chicago Cubs, or Louisville Slugger says, we provide the bats to the major leagues or whatever. And really good players, the Barry Bondses don't ever have to pay for their gloves or bats or anything like that.
Yeah.
So a lot of that cost is actually absorbed through the sort of way that business is done. I will tell you that the people who work in baseball, and I know this from having asked a lot of them, most people who work in baseball on the administrative side, in the front offices, even the managers and coaches, these people do not make that much money. It is a business in which almost all of the salary is front-loaded. In other words, it's spent on the talent. It's very much like Hollywood, like most other entertainment industries, in which the contracts are for the talent, because the understanding is that people are going to come out to watch the talent. They don't care as much about the infrastructure. They just want it to work, but they don't really have any concern about sort of a parity in salaries. The people who work in the front offices make a pittance of what they could make if they were to use their skills in a regular sort of business.
Let's talk again with another caller here. Let's go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My mother is 99 currently, and she has been a Cub fan for over 80 of those years, and I'm wondering, she can watch the games, her eyesight is well enough, and she has cable to see the games currently, but she doesn't read well because of her eyes, and is your book on tape by any chance? So we can get it?
That's a wonderful question, and one that we had been thinking about, but as of yet have not developed plans to do it. What I'll do is I'll talk to the publisher today and raise that point.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are Cub fans, and they have the time, and they would just love to read your book or hear your book.
That's a wonderful question, and I really appreciate the interest, because the whole point of writing the book was to really connect with people who care about the history of the team and of the park and the history of baseball and the history of Chicago. So, cheers to your mom. I really hope that this is the year that the Cubs win the series for her.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other comments or questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest is Stuart Shea. He's a baseball journalist. He's the author of a book that looks at the history of Wrigley Field, and the title of the book is Wrigley Field, The Unauthorized Biography. Brassies Incorporated is the publisher of the book. There's just so many little fascinating stories and things about the park that make it special. And just another one I'm interested in having you talk about is the scoreboard, because the scoreboard that's there, it was built in the 30s. It's still apparently the original scoreboard, and it's still operated by hand. Are there any others like that in Major League Baseball?
Well, the scoreboard in the Green Monster in Fenway Park in Boston still has a lot of the numbers for the inning-by-inning score and the batter, those are operated by hand. In fact, I'd say probably that the left field scoreboard in Fenway Park is even more Spartan than the one at Wrigley Field. They will occasionally have a TV feature on going in back of the Green Monster and what the environment is like back there, and there are know, there have been rats there and things like that. I don't know if they've ever had rats in the scoreboard at Wrigley, just because it's raised to a pretty high level off the ground. But the scoreboard at Wrigley was built in 1938, rather opened in 1938 for opening day, and it was just at the time it was looked on as the crown in the, you know, the crown jewel of any ballpark in the country. That scoreboard was sort of the final piece of the perfection that was viewed as Wrigley Field at that time. It was for that time it was a huge scoreboard. It was seen as not only functional but also truly beautiful, and it still really defines Chicago to me the way maybe only two or three other physical entities can define Chicago. You have the Wrigley Field scoreboard, you have the columns at Soldier Field, you have the Wrigley building itself, the John Hancock building. These are things that scream Chicago. One of the things that that P.K. Wrigley did in the 1930s was he really had an idea of the aesthetic value of the ballpark to make it a place where people really wanted to be. Beautiful Wrigley Field was not just a marketing slogan. That was the real philosophy of the team. They could sell the ballpark. They could sell beautiful Wrigley Field as much as they could sell baseball.
Well, were there times along the years when people argued strenuously for a different, a more modern and electronic scoreboard?
Well, there have been times when people said, well, it would be better if we did this or that or the other thing. And they put on an electronic auxiliary scoreboard along the third base upper deck, sort of facing of the third base upper deck in the 60s, and that remains there now. And in the early 80s, they put a small electronic message board on the bottom of the scoreboard, and that remains there now. But I think that's about as electronic as people seem to want to be. I think people go to Wrigley Field because they want a reminder of the fact that life wasn't always as crazy and complicated as it is now. Now, of course, life always was complicated, but since all the changes that have happened to Wrigley Field are mostly changes that have happened in 60 or more years ago, except for the lights, I tend to think that we look at Wrigley Field as a symbol of the past that was much less complicated and much easier to understand. And I really truly believe that baseball's charm is in its complete diametric opposition to the pace of American life. And that's what makes it special to people, and that's why people love it, because it really feels like an escape.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the lights for a second, because this, and it's my understanding that this year will mark only the 18th year of night baseball at Wrigley. The lights went in 1988. Why did it take so long for them to put in the lights?
Good question. It certainly wasn't because they didn't want to sell a Wrigley Field with evening events. If you go back to 1914, the first year of the park, they actually at times brought in portable lighting to have things like fireworks shows and vaudeville shows even. There were actually vaudeville shows on the infield of Wrigley Field. And there were things like basketball games and boxing matches and wrestling matches and ski jumping tournaments and religious gatherings. All sorts of things were done at Wrigley Field all the way up to the 50s, and a lot of them were done at night. And so they were bringing portable lighting. I think the solution to the question of why didn't the Cubs have lights for night baseball was in the character of P.K. Wrigley, who was a very quiet man, unlike his father Bill, who was very genial and fun and kind of a people's guy. P.K. Wrigley was quiet and reserved and very self-motivated. And Bill Veeck, the fantastic later owner of the White Sox, who spent a lot of his youth working at Wrigley Field, said that he thinks that P.K. Wrigley didn't want to have lights because he didn't think of it first. And in some ways, that's a little unfair, but I think that P.K. Wrigley did have that sort of character of wanting to be his own man, and didn't want to do things just because other people did them. He always said he didn't want to bother the neighborhood with lights, but the fact that they did other things at night, boxing matches and basketball games and the like, sort of makes me question the sincerity of that. There is the story that the Cubs ordered a lighting system for the 1942 season, and they were all ready to start installing it on December 8th, which would have been a Monday. Unfortunately, December 7th was Pearl Harbor, and at that point, Wrigley decided to donate all the materials that were going to be used for a lighting system to the War Department. And I don't believe that, I believe that story is true because it came from the former Cubs general manager, Jim Gallagher, and it was told to Jerome Holtzman in the 70s, who was a great Chicago baseball writer. So I believe that story, that Wrigley didn't really want to do lights. He only wanted to do it as a last resort because the club wasn't drawing very well. But he was happy to have an excuse to not do it.
You mentioned there in passing Bill Veeck, and certainly his is an important name associated with Chicago baseball, as you say, and what a lot of people will think of as the White Sox. But he did before that have an association with the Cubs and with Wrigley Field. And the story is apparently that he's the guy, ultimately the guy that we have to thank for the ivy.
Well, this is a story that has always fascinated me because I've never been able to find any concrete evidence that the planting of the ivy happened as he described it in his own biography, his autobiography, Veeck as in Wreck. He talks about planting it overnight because Phil Wrigley wanted to have some friends in to see this beautiful new ivy. But the evidence doesn't point to that being true. The evidence points to the ivy being planted late in the 1937 season, but certainly not completely strung in there overnight and certainly not looking like we think it does now. The photos from late in 1937 and, in fact, early in 1938 show that there was ivy planted in the ground that was working its way up the outfield wall, but not necessarily that it was all planted from the top down. It's certainly not done overnight the way that we would think. I would assume that what happened is that Bill Veeck and some guys from the Clavey Nursery up in, I believe, Woodstock, Illinois, came in and planted some things in the ground before the day that Wrigley was supposed to come in and see his progress. But there was no sort of covert flashlight-wielding bunch of gardeners who came in and planted an entire 400-foot range of ivy on the wall the way we think of it now. It was much more, I think, of a slow operation because it took the time for not only the ivy, but really the bittersweet, which was planted before the ivy because it grows quicker, to catch on. I think it's a great piece of myth-making from Bill Veeck, basically.
Yeah.
And the truth to me is much more interesting because the idea of seeing the pictures at that time that you see in the newspapers of these little strands of ivy growing up the outfield walls, to me is kind of interesting because that, to me, would be much stranger than just coming in and seeing a whole thing being planted overnight. It took several months for this really to grow to what we know of now. But I think Bill Veeck is to his credit that he came up with the idea of doing this, of implementing it to sort of surprise his employer. Because Bill Veeck was very much into promotion and really wanted to sell. He was even more interested in selling Wrigley Field than P.K. Wrigley was. Veeck wanted to do things that Wrigley never would have stood for. One thing that Veeck did do, and I know that I'm running down on time here, is he is responsible for having the little blue and white lights outside of the Wrigley Field bleachers that indicate whether the Cubs won or lost that day.
Hmm. So. We are coming down to maybe having a minute or two left. There are so many stories connected with the park and also with things that happened in the park, great historic moments in baseball and, you know, and other things as well. Is there anything that among all of those things, say, let's just talk about history of baseball, things that have occurred in that park that stands out in your mind as being a really iconic kind of baseball story?
That's a great question. I would say that, well, Wrigley Field is the first place that fans were allowed to keep foul balls. This was not done in the early days of baseball because baseballs were expensive. But Charles Wiegman in 1916 started this trend whereby he allowed fans to keep foul balls. And this was a real sensation at the time. And it was just more good publicity for the Cubs. The Cubs were also one of the first teams to have radio broadcasting of their games. Bill Wrigley believed in radio, and he thought it would be a great promotion for the Cubs to put the games on the radio and let fans know what they're missing by not being out at the ballpark. Those are two classic things for me. Another funny thing is that people don't realize that P.K. Wrigley actually considered installing artificial turf in the 1960s because it would have been cheaper. Luckily, he abandoned that idea fairly soon, so we didn't end up having artificial turf at Wrigley Field.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up, but there is much, much more in this book. And again, I want to make sure that people who are listening, if you are Cubs fans or if you're just fans of baseball, I'm sure that you would enjoy reading the book. And it's all about the history of Wrigley Field, and the title is Wrigley Field, The Unauthorized Biography. Brassey's Incorporated is the publisher, by our guest, Stuart Shea. He's a baseball journalist, has written about baseball for Total Sports, America Online, and he's joining us from his home in Chicago. Stuart, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, I really appreciate it. If people want to know more, they can also go to the website, www.wrigleybook.com.